Chapter 2. Ethical Medicine in the Republic of Science. For most of human history, people who mixed and applied medicines were held apart. Even in cultures where everything was in some sense sacred, healers and their tools were nearest the gods, possessors of the most powerful magic. In Amazonian cultures, shamanic medicine men, by custom, have lived in remote isolation. Their counterparts in pagan and early Christian Europe, such as the Druids and medieval women who were keepers of medical plant knowledge, magic, and lore, later denounced and terminated as practitioners of witchcraft, lived in or on the edges of forests and were said to commune with spirits. The oldest records of a connection between medicine, magic, and religion are clay tablets dating to 3000 BC. They illustrate the reverence shown in ancient Sumer to the healing goddess Gula, the great physician, user of herbs and powerful incantations. This overlap persisted well after the birth of reason in ancient Greece. The culture that produced Aristotle and the Hippocratic Oath also worshipped Asclepius, god of medicine and healing. For centuries after the Roman physician Galen began to systematically disentangle the scientific from the supernatural, the cult of Asclepius flourished throughout the empire and near Asia. Adherents suffering illness would sleep in his temples in hopes that he would appear in their dreams, carrying a staff wrapped by a single coiled serpent, a symbol of health and sickness inherited from the Sumerians. Hermes, the god of commerce, was represented by a similar rod entwined with two snakes rather than one. These snakes often had wings that, in Roman telling, represented speed, with Hermes appearing as Mercury, the messenger god. The rod of Asclepius did not have wings because speed was thought to be antithetical to healing, and the rod was associated with the administration of opium, a frequently used medicine. Which symbol is used, one or two snakes, flanked or not flanked by wings, is important because, for both the Greeks and the Romans, medicine was an art of the temple, not the bazaar. In the temple, a place set apart, avoidance of harm is paramount. The agora, by contrast, is a place of risk, haggling, and aggrandizement. That the modern health industry sometimes confuses the two ancient symbols is a poetic and revealing error. As a healer of last resort for the poor, the cult of Asclepius was so popular it threatened to undermine the recruitment efforts of the early Christians, who considered the popular Greek god to be the most serious rival to Jesus Christ. The eventual substitution of Asclepius by Jesus owes less to the promise of eternal salvation than the tireless promotion of the latter's superior healing power. The close association between Christianity and healing colored the development of Christian teachings on the duty to attend to the suffering of all those made in God's image. Red Sea miracles that cured blindness were followed by cloister clinics for the poor and afflicted, administered by monks and later nuns. Out of these emerged the first hospitals. Medicine's base in religious institutions shaped the conception of knowledge described in the previous chapter. Medical and scientific knowledge especially were considered gifts from the mind of God, free to all and belonging to no earthly power. Any expression or use of this knowledge, including novel and potentially profitable ones, remained God's gift. To traffic in its fruits was a sin of simony, writes the historian and critic Lewis Hyde. This script is captured in the often quoted line of Martin Luther, later echoed by Benjamin Franklin. Freely have I received, freely have I given, and I desire nothing in return. When the Enlightenment created space between religion and science, it secularized the medieval belief in the sacredness of knowledge. Medical science occupied a hallowed place in an age of reason, defined by rapid advances in the physical and natural sciences. Many Enlightenment figures were physicians, naturalists, or some combination of the two. They believed the application of reason would unlock the secrets of human health, now seen as the natural state of man. Illness was not the physical manifestation of sin or the work of demon spirits, as had previously been taught. It was a problem to be studied and solved. Those doing the studying and the solving were citizens of a borderless republic of science, deploying reason to vanquish disease and suffering in service to all mankind. Reason's potential appeared limitless, promising the eventual conquest of death itself. It is possible to imagine. Ben Franklin wrote to the eminent British scientist Joseph Priestley in 1780, "All diseases may, by sure means, be prevented or cured, not excepting even that of old age, and our lives lengthened at pleasure even beyond the antediluvian standard." While pondering the prospect of physical immortality, it is unlikely that Franklin imagined the wondrous medicines of distant centuries being strictly controlled in a futuristic version of royal monopoly privilege. The idea would have seemed far-fetched and pessimistic in an optimistic age. But it was Franklin who told the waiting Philadelphia crowd that they had a republic if you can keep it. He understood that while scientific knowledge and progress were irrepressible, the republican values enjoyed no such guarantee. In the English patent tradition, medicine's sacred origins informed a compromise. Techniques used to manufacture medicines were legitimate subjects for patent consideration, but not the medicines themselves. As European states began to adopt patent systems in the 19th century, they followed the English lead in drawing a hard distinction between medical process and product patents. If a European drug maker wished to claim a monopoly on a new drug, they had to make the transatlantic crossing to the United States. In permitting the patenting of medical products, the United States remained an outlier well into the 20th century. For most of this time, it was a global oddity with the added quirk of having a split personality. The dual U.S. drug economy contained one market for so-called patent medicines, the herbal mixtures and potions that promised to cure every possible ailment and formed one of the busiest, most colorful, and most profitable trades in 19th century America. The opposing drug economy was self-consciously sober and staid in comparison, less profitable by design and limited to the official pharmacopoeia maintained by a class of elite medical gatekeepers. This so-called ethical wing of medicine dismissed the peddlers of patent cures with disdain. The quotations around ethical should be understood with two meanings in mind. While trumpeting the humanistic ideals of open publication and the knowledge commons, the gatekeepers of ethical medicine also condoned medical experimentation on slaves, colonial subjects, prisoners, and the mentally handicapped. This parallel history continued into the middle of the 20th century. During its national conferences of the 1930s, the American Medical Association would spend the morning debating the morality of patenting medicines, then celebrate the architects of the Tuskegee syphilis study in the afternoon. The self-appointed keepers of the Enlightenment flame consider themselves dual citizens of the United States and an international, trans-historical republic of science. One of the fastest ways to lose this second passport was to break the hard taboo against all forms of profiteering and secrecy in medicine, symbolized by the patent monopoly. The ethical medical and pharmaceutical guilds were allied in a profound belief in their own supposed benevolence and dedication to the advancement of scientific knowledge, writes Joseph M. Gabriel, the preeminent historian of 19th century American medical ethics and mores. For most physicians, there was little difference between patenting and secrecy when it came to drugs. Both were considered unethical forms of selfish monopoly. Indeed, it was generally assumed that patented remedies and quack nostrums were the same thing. The capital of ethical medicine was Philadelphia. The University of Pennsylvania Medical School and College of Pharmacy, together with a number of influential professional and trade associations, closely monitored their professions for rogue attempts to grow fat on human misery, as one 19th century gatekeeper described profiting from medicines. At its founding convention in Philadelphia in 1847, the forerunner of the American Medical Association adopted a code of ethics, declaring patents incompatible with the duty and obligation enjoined upon physicians to advance the knowledge of curing diseases. Describing patents as derogatory to professional character, the association forbade members from seeking patents or prescribing patented medicines. The code was modeled closely on a statement of principles published by the Medical Society of New York in 1823. Both reflected a view of medical science as an island of virtue and reason in a sea of avarice and flim-flam. Where orthodox medicine led, pharmacists and drug companies followed. In 1852, the newly formed American Pharmaceutical Association adopted a strict anti-patent policy. At its founding convention, also in Philadelphia, the drug maker cited an ethical duty to ensure medical discoveries and related science are widely disseminated for the nation's and the species' benefit. The druggists adopted the doctor's broad philosophical approach to the patent taboo, couching the prohibition in a rejection of the myth of the lone genius. Given the cumulative nature of scientific discovery, in which increment is added to increment over the span of time, claims of being sole inventor were deemed fraudulent. Succumbing to the temptations of medical monopoly guaranteed exile from the Republic of Science and excoriating public censure. the Philadelphia doctor who patented a novel twist on curative leaching in 1805, found his claim roundly ignored, infringed, and denounced as unjust and illiberal, a knavish piece of monopoly. This was the standard treatment of any physician, scientist, or druggist who sought riches by controlling access to medical discoveries. If a medicine was patented, it was reasoned other physicians could not investigate it freely or prescribe it to their patients as they saw fit, writes Gabriel in his History of Early American Medical Ethics, Medical Monopoly. Secrecy was also understood as a form of monopoly that undermined the progress of medical science and threatened the public. On the other side of the ethical divide was a busy continental traffic in cure-all potions and nostrums, noisy with jostling entrepreneurs and hustlers, mostly untrained in medicine and pharmacy. There was no such thing as honest haberdashery or moral masonry, because those professions were not divided into camps with wildly divergent values, styles, and missions. Name-brand patent medicines were ubiquitous and tremendously profitable. The best-selling medicine of the 19th century was Brandreth's Vegetable Pills, a blood-purifying purgative used by an estimated 150 million Americans at its mid-century peak. Its promise to build up a new and sound body in place of one feeble or diseased may have been bogus, but it did build a new and sound fortune for the patent medicine magnate Benjamin Brandreth, whose factories occupied a New York City block by the late 1830s. The national market for patented purgatives was so busy, it was a cliché of the age to say that the way to open a man's purse was to open his bowels. Among the hustles of a young P.T. Barnum on the make was writing copy for patent medicine labels and advertisements. Later in his life, as a famous impresario, his Barnum-branded patent medicines were known by a brash marketing campaign that symbolized everything ethical pharmacy defined itself against. A campaign for Barnum's proprietary castor oils featured the image of his biggest circus star, Jumbo, a giant African bush elephant he purchased in 1882 from London's Royal Zoological Gardens. Barnum-style hustlers and cure-all-selling conmen were common characters and tropes in the literature of the time. The title charlatan of Herman Melville's 1857 novel, The Confidence Man, is an herb doctor who sells bottles to profit in the name of a fraudulent charity. Mark Twain immortalized patent medicine quackery in The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, and then again in the characters of Duke and the King in The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. The Twain novel that gave the era its name, The Gilded Age, follows the adventures of Colonel Beriah Sellers, peddler of a product known as the Infallible Imperial Oriental Optic Liniment and Salvation for Sore Eyes, consisting of 9/10 water and 1/10 whatever ingredients don't cost more than a dollar a barrel. In 1905, Twain received a solicitation from the San Francisco proprietor of a new patent medicine called T. Duffy's Solution, described by its maker, J.H. Todd, as the elixir of life, blood purifier, antiseptic, disease destroyer, and giver of life everlasting. Twain called in his secretary and dictated a response that was never mailed. A few moments from now, my resentment will have faded and passed, and I shall probably even be praying for you, it reads. But while there is yet time, I hasten to wish that you may take a dose of your own poison by mistake and enter swiftly into the damnation which you and all other patent medicine assassins have so remorselessly earned and do so richly deserve. According to K. Patrick Ober, author of Mark Twain and Medicine, the writer privately admitted in a letter to a friend that the only thing that helped his hemorrhoids was a nostrum he described as a rather deadly quack medicine. In fairness, there was good reason to seek out nostrums and settle for their questionable effects, including the as-yet-unnamed placebo effect. Until the advent of scientific medicine toward the end of the 19th century, the options available to physicians were rudimentary, meager, and full of pain. The foremost physician in early America, Benjamin Rush, was a fanatical advocate of bleeding to treat just about any illness. The esteemed former Surgeon General of the Continental Army advanced the view that all disease resulted from an excess in capillary tension and should be managed by heavy bleeding and purging. It was muttered that Rush shed more blood than any general in history, drawing the vital fluid from his patients till they were as pale as Jersey veal. The miserable limitations of pre-scientific medicine also worked to reinforce the patent taboo. With so few effective solutions to suffering and disease, what could possibly justify monopoly claims on the few tools that actually alleviated pain and cure disease? This was the question hurled in outrage at a Boston dentist named William Morton in 1846, following his discovery that sulfuric ether could safely suppress consciousness during surgery. Had Morton simply published his findings, his name would have been celebrated for ending one of humanity's longest-running horrors. For thousands of years, surgery had been performed on conscious patients held down by the force of men. The only palliatives available were wine, opium, and with any luck, blackout. But Morton was a dentist, not a doctor steeped in the ethical code of the guild, and he successfully sought a patent on his discovery. This triggered a wrathful response from organized medicine aimed not at the U.S. Patent Office, but at Morton for using its services. This response could sound indistinguishable from genuine incomprehension. As one doctor told a Boston medical journal, "Why must I now purchase the right to use ether as a patent medicine? It would seem to me like patent sunlight." The first attempt to answer this question within the framework of ethical medicine was made by a New York City physician and pharmacist named Francis E. Stewart. After earning degrees from the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy and Jefferson Medical College, Stewart established a New York City medical practice with a side career in drug research. His life took a dramatic turn early in his career when he discovered an effective treatment for wasting disease. The ethical code of the time called for Stewart to publish the substance of his discovery in the medical journals, then allow others to follow up his work and determine its value. Instead, he crossed a bright red line by accepting a partnership with George Davis of the Detroit-based Park Davis Drug Company. Park Davis was itself known for pushing at the edges of ethical manufacturing by advertising its products with illustrations and dramatic flourishes that, it seemed to some, veered closer to Barnum than the sober text-only ads of most approved medicines. In 1877, the American Medical Association passed bylaws banning testimonials and endorsements in the advertisements for products listed in its approved pharmacopoeia. When Stewart partnered with Park Davis, the usual insults ensued, including calls for his professional excommunication. His crime was not in patenting his treatment for wasting disease, but in helping the company promote it for use before its inclusion in the list of approved medicines featured in the pharmacopoeia, a tome updated only once every 10 years. The system Stewart devised with Park Davis for bypassing the pharmacopoeia involved compiling reports of the results in each hospital using the new treatment. When 25 of these working bulletins came back, they were presented to the journals for summary publication. The original 1881 version of Stewart's working bulletin system did not push against the patent taboo. Although he and Park Davis were beginning to have quiet doubts about that stricture too, they understood that monopoly control of the drug in question would cast doubt on the bulletins by increasing the incentive, or the perception of such an incentive, to bury or ignore negative bulletins, which were essentially human field trials. Another decade would pass before Park Davis began to edge closer to the ethical third rail of medical patents. When a competing firm used its bulletin reports to scoop Park Davis's market for a new plant-based laxative, George Davis judged the episode an apt illustration of the unpractical working of our ethical policy in the present condition of affairs. In 1894, his company set a major precedent by receiving a process patent on the production of an enzyme found to aid digestion. With Davis's support, Stewart took these controversial ideas into the belly of the beast, offering himself as proof that it was possible to work with industry without betraying the ideals of the old ethical code. He lectured to skeptical medical and scientific audiences around the country on the need for reform. For 3 decades, Stewart walked this line in public view, seeding his working bulletin model as one of the first medical men to offer unapologetic, full-service consulting to the drug industry. Thus did Stewart emerge as the standard-bearer for the novel concept of ethical drug patenting. In Joseph Gabriel's estimation, he became perhaps the best-known expert on patent law and its relationship to pharmacy in the medical and pharmaceutical communities, publishing widely. In dozens of articles, including a series in the Journal of the American Medical Association, he argued that patents aligned with the ethical dictate to circulate medical knowledge because a thing patented was a thing divulged. Moreover, he argued, patents could help fund the expensive modern laboratories required in the dawning age of scientific medicine. In the middle of the 20th century, drug companies would make a public relations art and industry out of this justification for patents first articulated by Stewart, refining it for deployment against any and all criticism of its power, profits, and prices. Stewart's liberality did not extend to the use of trademarks and brand names, the use of which he believed could be used to turn a temporary monopoly into a permanent one by cementing the association between a brand and the medicine for all time. On this issue, Davis and Stewart joined their conservative brethren to keep newly arrived trademark German drugs out of the pharmacopoeia. The taboo against medical monopolies weakened in the century following the cracks inflicted by Stewart. The next generation of Parke Davis executives would live to see the making and selling of medicines dominated by corporations that openly wielded intellectual property claims in brazen pursuit of profit and market control. They would do so in alliance with their old associates in ethical medicine, the medical establishment, whose role flipped from senior partner and guardian of an ancient code to handmaiden and accomplice tasked with using its social esteem to erase that code's legacy. This was still a fantastical prospect when Stewart planted a heretical flag for ethical patenting inside the House of Medicine around the turn of the century. It would continue to seem so during the jagged and multi-decade erosion process whose most important players were not Parke Davis or any other U.S. drug company. While the most respected native firms conferred with the deans in Philadelphia and measured the moral consequences of loosening the patent taboo, no sentimental attachment slowed down the chemical-pharmaceutical combines of Wilhelmina, Germany that stormed the U.S. drug market in the 1880s. German scientists did much of the work that brought medicine into the modern age. The paradigm-smashing breakthroughs of the Kaiser's lavishly funded research centers rivaled the Pasteur Institute in developing the fields of bacteriology and immunology. The German chemical industry, meanwhile, oversaw leaps in organic chemistry that enabled the production of synthetic dyes and drugs based on coal tar. These firms' biggest market was the United States, where they were a major presence in the new industrial economy. In Washington, D.C., their U.S. lawyers were regular visitors to the U.S. Patent Office, amassing hundreds of patents on increasingly essential chemical products and processes. In New York, German drug companies established subsidiaries and hired law firms to extend and protect their patent monopolies. Many favored the services of H.A. Metz & Company, run by a 33-year-old dynamo named Hermann Metz, a chemist-turned-businessman who divided his time importing chemicals, overseeing their manufacture, and enforcing patents on behalf of German clients, like the chemical and drugs firm Werke Heist Aktiengesellschaft. The arrival of the German companies transformed the U.S. drug economy, the research landscape, and the legal and cultural mores around them. Until then, the use of patent barricades to obstruct the study and sale of medicines was, as the foreign newcomers to the industry might say, verboten. It was known in other industries, but not pharmaceuticals. With rare exceptions, patents were still associated with the mass-market stuff peddled by P.T. Barnum and other fraudsters of bright plumage and no scientific training. The German firms pioneered the patent as an instrument for building and protecting exclusive markets around drugs that otherwise appeared ethical. Aside from the use of trademarks, the products were marketed to doctors in the sober fashion expected of ethical drug companies. More important, they were real contributions to medicine that could not be ignored. They presented a thorny dilemma for the House of Medicine and U.S. drug makers. In their bylaws and codes of conduct, the American Medical and Pharmaceutical Associations barred the prescribing of patented and trademark drugs on principle, believing that any trusted drug should be available to all and subject to research and price competition. At the same time, how could the establishment justify blocking the approval of new breakthrough drugs of incontrovertible benefit? The German patent strategy went beyond the establishment of market monopolies. The firms conducted a carefully devised strategy of patenting every chemical in the course of the research effort, effectively patenting around the final marketable drug, writes the industry historian Jonathan Liebenau. This technique was successful in discouraging competition because there was little incentive to work through a development phase when patents were already held on every conceivable related product. The chemical and drug firm Farbenfabriken Wormels Friedrich Bayer gained notoriety for deploying these strategies around a string of breakthrough drugs that they were barred from patenting elsewhere, including the Kaiser's Germany. Throughout the 1880s and 1890s, the firm's U.S. subsidiary, the Bayer Company, took out patents on three synthetic wonder drugs. The first was a powerful sedative released in 1887 called sulfonol. It was followed a year later by a fever-reducing pill called phenacetine. Both drugs were popular, but also the source of much grumbling. An ounce of phenacetine cost 6 cents in Germany, 15 cents in England, Canada, and Europe, and $1 in the United States, where Bayer enjoyed its only monopoly. The fenacetin patent was followed in 1889 by a third that broke the dam of public and professional anchor. That year, Bayer debuted a new anti-inflammatory and anti-pain medicine under the brand name of aspirin. Acetylsalicylic acid, its scientific name, had been synthesized by Felix Hoffmann 2 years earlier, in August 1897. The same month, Hoffmann created a powerful synthetic opiate the company marketed as heroin. A synthetic derivative of willow leaf tea, Bayer sold aspirin as a white powder in glass bottles that took on a Janus-faced symbolism. Immediately and widely adopted as a standard treatment for headaches and rheumatism, it was a true wonder drug of its time. It was also a hated symbol of un-American medical monopoly. By the standards of ethical medicine, the patenting of the first non-addictive pain reliever was the crudest German obscenity of them all. Yet aspirin's unquestionable utility and scientific origin left the country's medical gatekeepers with an impossible choice. They could take a stand for the anti-monopoly code and deny aspirin medical legitimacy, or they could accept yet another Bayer monopoly as the changing price of progress in an age of corporatized scientific medicine. The price wasn't only a metaphor for principles. Bayer's markups of aspirin in the United States rivaled those of fenacetin. The medical associations and the major drug manufacturers temporized. Not so the nation's neighborhood and corner druggists. For them, the stakes went beyond the profession's code of ethics. The prepackaged and branded Bayer products also represented an attack on guild interests by threatening the tradition of mixing and preparing generic drugs in-house. In a future shaped by the branded Bayer model, their skills would be obsolete. In response to the introduction of trademarked fenacetin, the druggists worked with smugglers to bring in black market Bayer products and resell them at costs similar to those available in Canada. When the first aspirin monopoly prices were announced in 1899, they expanded the smuggling network and began pouring resources into an organized public campaign against the German patents. The agitation and infringement campaign continued in one form or another until the United States entered the European War in 1917. Waged through criminal networks, speaking tours, the press, congressional proxies, and personal visits to the White House, the druggists' war on Bayer put a spotlight on the newly relevant matter of the legal and moral right to control the price and market of an important new medicine. The aspirin war's main front was one of the most extensive and systematic smuggling operations in the nation's history. Within a year of aspirin's arrival in the U.S. market, black marketeers in cahoots with the nation's druggists were supplying much of the country with wholesale shipments of staggering size, both packaged drugs and their bulk ingredients, brought across U.S. land borders and into its ports. Thomas M. Reimer described the network in an unpublished history dissertation. Many smugglers worked from the Canadian border, out of reach of Bayer, for they broke no Canadian law. To avoid being chased by Treasury secret agents for smuggling, the more astute paid duty, and worked through peddlers to avoid charges of mail fraud. As long as they only infringed Bayer's patent rights, they committed a tort and not a felony, and Bayer was on its own until it could obtain and serve an injunction, after which smugglers who persisted were in contempt of court. Many retail druggists hailed them as freedom fighters. Few druggists could claim they were just on the sidelines of this operation. As the smuggling network expanded, so did the number of bootleggers and aspirin mules in police custody. In plea deals, they revealed an operation of continental scope, naming enough names for Bayer to threaten suit against 7,000 retail druggists, or roughly one out of every 5 pharmacists in the country. Unable to bring suit against them all, Bayer's U.S. lawyers selected targets for maximum impact. By 1906, the company had pressed charges against 800 community pharmacies. The country's local pharmacists believed they had justice and national custom on their side, regardless of the legal status of the Bayer patents. When Bayer's lawyers began working with local and federal police to dismantle the aspirin black market, the druggists dug in. Knowing they had the public sympathy, they used Bayer's lawsuits as rallying points and press opportunities. One early inflection point came in November 1896, 3 years before the aspirin patent, following the arrest of a Denver drug distributor named Hugh Tinling on charges of illegally importing 125 pounds of Bayer fenacetin. When the company's lawyers demanded Tinling pay a heavy fine and publicly recognize the validity of Bayer's patent, he refused. Tinling instead denounced Bayer's greed in exploiting his country's peculiar and immoral tolerance of medicine monopolies. The Circuit Court of Appeals judge overseeing the case disagreed. He rebuked Tinling for dragging immaterial antitrust issues into the case and upheld Bayer's injunction. The case added fuel to what had become a druggist-led prairie fire of anti-monopoly activity. Behind the radical leadership, by druggist standards, of the Chicago Retail Druggist Association, regional groups of druggists filed a flurry of suits, challenging Bayer's patent claim of novelty. Their efforts mirrored a campaign in England, the only country other than the United States to briefly grant Bayer an aspirin patent. In 1905, an English High Court judge voided Bayer's aspirin patent as unoriginal, leading to changes that tightened that nation's laws around drug patents and sharpened the contrast between the United States and the rest of the world. As in the United States, the German firm's ingenious use of elaborate patenting strategies was poorly received in England. Big German syndicates have one very effective way of destroying British industry, observed Lloyd George, England's Minister of Trade at the time. They first of all apply for patents on a very considerable scale that suggest every possible combination which human ingenuity can possibly think of, but are not in operation, so as to cover any possible invention that may be discovered afterwards in this country. Bayer and America's druggists entered the 20th century like two entangled fighters. The druggists continued to land punches in the press, extending their starting advantage in public sympathies, and stepped up lobbying efforts through the National Association of Retail Druggists, NARD, founded in 1898. Bayer rolled with NARD's punches and continued to find satisfaction in the courts. Frustration over Bayer's strong legal position was palpable at the 1901 meeting of the American Pharmaceutical Association, convened shortly after a federal judge dismissed a patent challenge by the Pennsylvania Pharmaceutical Association. During the rowdy proceedings, a Western Pennsylvania druggist lambasted the timidity of the medical establishment, the pharmacist's traditional ally, and implored the House of Medicine to join their fight to knock the grasp of this devilfish that is leaving no method allowed to them within legal bounds unused to rob the sick and suffering of the United States. Joseph Helfman, the editor of Bulletin of Pharmacy, spoke on abuses of proprietary rights in pharmacy, and called for scorched-earth resistance to foreign drug companies that priced products in the United States at significant markups over prices in Canada and Europe. The druggists and their allies had grounds for optimism as the 20th century opened. The early progressives injected life into the country's anti-monopoly tradition and called for the tighter regulation of industry. Opposition to foreign monopoly power seemed to be growing stronger by the year. By 1900, more than 90% of U.S. patents on chemical processes and products were issued to foreign firms and conglomerates. The Spanish-American War of 1898 had unleashed a jingoism that dovetailed with these concerns, as did a flourishing new form of journalism known as muckraking that focused on the depredations of the modern corporation. The spirited public mood was reflected in a 1902 article by Wilhelm Bodeman, chair of the Illinois State Board of Pharmacy. Widely distributed by NARD, the piece detailed the multiple insults inflicted by Bayer on the United States. The Bayer patents, Bodeman argued, were immoral because they blocked related research by American scientists, exploited the U.S. legal system to pick the country's pockets, and forced upon its people the final humiliation of knowing monopoly prices paid in dollars were padding the foreign currency vaults of that effete monarchy in Berlin. In October 1903, NARD gathered for its first national convention in Washington, D.C. During the proceedings, the group sent a delegation to the White House, where Theodore Roosevelt listened to their complaint that Bayer was fleecing Americans in a way no other country would allow. The delegation left the meeting in high spirits, believing that Roosevelt was on their side. What they didn't know was that the president was being pressured from the other side by the U.S. Patent Commissioner, Frederick I. Allen, who believed the druggists petty and thought the aspirin patent should be protected until its natural expiration in 1916. Allen counseled Roosevelt to adhere to the nation's obligations as a signatory to the 1883 Paris Convention, which mandated that nations grant foreign firms the same intellectual property protections as domestic firms. The fact that U.S. drug companies generally did not seek these protections was irrelevant. When Allen's counsel to Roosevelt was leaked, the Western druggist called for the commissioner's immediate firing. The promptings of avarice and the rule of might as against right, the paper said, shall not be part of our national or international policy. The thriving underground trade in generic and smuggled Bayer aspirin and phenacetin had a fatal flaw, quality control. While many professional druggists dealt only in Bayer-produced pills and active ingredients smuggled directly from Europe and Canada, others bought their headache powers from bootleggers and middlemen, who replaced one of the Bayer ingredients, acetophenedetin, with a mixture of talcum and acetanilide, a dangerous heart suppressant that cost a third as much. Reports of deaths and illness caused by acetanilide received national exposure in Collier's magazine in the fall of 1905. The revelation was made as part of an investigative series about the patent medicine industry by Samuel Hopkins Adams, entitled The Great American Fraud. In turning the public's attention to questions of drug regulation and safety, the articles had the effect of recasting the politics of the Bayer patent war. Now the story was less black and white. Greed was evident on both sides. Citing the series, Bayer's representatives positioned the firm as the protector of standards and public safety. It was an effective strategy, both with the public and with the medical establishment that was already nervous about accusations. It was allying with criminals engaged in potentially harmful adulteration. When leading medical journals started distancing themselves from the druggist crusade, Bayer's U.S. lawyers sent copies of the editorials to 75,000 doctors around the country. The druggists countered with mailers of their own. An editorial in the Druggist Circular argued that the Germans were ultimately to blame for any harm resulting from adulteration. An ethical U.S. drug firm, after all, would not have engaged in the monopoly pricing that led to the smuggling and powder cutting in the first place. But the larger ethical firms were unusually quiet on the issue. Like the doctors, they feared association with criminality as well as Bayer's lawyers. Some of them, covetous of Bayer's monopoly profits and success in the courts, were also beginning the process of embracing Stewart's once heretical ideas about ethical patenting. The sudden and unexpected turn in the Bayer patent war caused by the Collier series proved decisive in shaping and passing the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906. Usually understood as the child of Upton Sinclair's depiction of the Chicago meatpacking industry in The Jungle, the 1906 law was just as much a child of Adams's Collier series and other contemporaneous reports of deaths from black market aspirin. The law made the selling of fake drugs a federal offense and required mandatory labeling for drugs containing a number of ingredients, including acetanilide. What the law did not do, to Bayer's chagrin, was end or even much reduce the American black market in aspirin. In 1909, with 7 years left on Bayer's patent, it was estimated that 75% of all aspirin sold in the United States was smuggled in from Canada and Europe after being purchased at much lower, non-monopoly prices abroad. There are plenty of ways to die young in the overcrowded slums of the 1890s, but few were as dreaded as the death caused by respiratory diphtheria. The fearsome bacteria preyed on small children, 5 or younger, with infection spread through sneezes and coughs. A sore throat and raspy voice were the first signs, followed by a thick mucous membrane that took root in the back of the throat. As the membrane grew, breathing became difficult, then excruciating. In about a quarter of cases, the afflicted slowly suffocated to death in their beds. Medical efforts to save diphtheria's young victims resulted in the first primitive attempts at medical intubation using rubber tubes. In the immigrant tenements, where the disease was most prevalent, the airborne germ was known as the strangling angel. Great hope greeted reports in 1888 that researchers at the Pasteur Institute in Paris had produced a moderately effective diphtheria anti-serum from infected animal plasma. The anti-serum was effective for only 2 weeks, but it could blunt outbreaks, and it was better than nothing. In Germany, a rival group of researchers began work to refine the process, led by a scientist and entrepreneur named Emil von Behring, then in the employ of Hoechst, a Frankfurt-based drug company. In 1895, Behring quietly applied for a U.S. patent on a method for harvesting the anti-serum from horse plasma. But the claim of novelty was so weak, and the audacity of the claim so far off the known scale of shame, that reports of Behring's application were not taken seriously. The medical world at first refused to credit a rumor which pointed to a line of action so contrary to the first principles of scientific ethics and morality, wrote the editors of The Lancet. In any event, the method was already being used by New York City's Municipal Health Department, and leading U.S. drug companies, Parke Davis and H.K. Mulford, were planning to begin commercial production. When the U.S. Patent Office approved Behring's claim on his horse plasma method in 1898, the transcontinental medical and pharmaceutical establishments reacted with a different kind of incredulity. They subjected Behring to waves of withering scorn. The medical age described Behring's pursuit of personal gain as evidence of a high degree of moral perversity. The Lancet took a slightly wider approach to its condemnation, rejecting the notion that anybody was entitled to be regarded as the sole discoverer of a method which was the outcome of slow and prolonged scientific investigation and reasoning pursued in all directions. The implications of the Bering-Hoist precedent troubled the editors as much as the specific monopoly grant in question. No one desires to see pharmacology entangled in a maze of monopolies of therapeutics dominated by patent medicines, they wrote. The editors of the American Medico-Surgical Bulletin argued that the effect of approving Bering's claim was to violate every principle of justice and negate the whole utility of patent law, and to steal from society its just heritage and give it to an individual. The diphtheria patent, they continued, stands in the way of all work in the same field and hinders progress. It can never in any manner encourage future discovery. It has its menacing hand up against seekers of new serums. It invades a department of research where work was going on with vigor and where the results would have gone to the public without money, patents or price. If other medical men follow in the wake of Bering, where shall we find ourselves? This starting or the closing of the doors of knowledge will prove a serious affair if not quickly arrested by the frowns of the profession. As we will see, the frowns of the profession proved incapable of arresting this closing of the doors. They creaked slowly at first, then shut with a slam. If this future was just becoming imaginable at the turn of the century, it still seemed distant and preventable. Bering's patent was first announced in the United States, then roundly ignored. So deeply was the patent loathed, Hoist's lawyers didn't bother to sue the companies that continued manufacturing the serum using Bering's method without interruption. When Bering was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1901, the AMA journal editorialized that his attempt to reap the benefit of the diphtheria vaccine should preclude him from award for humanitarian advances. A member of the old upper class, Bering did not need the money anyway, and he died a wealthy man in 1917. In the years after his death, Hoist, the company he helped build, continued to grow, eventually merging with five other companies to form IG Farben, a keystone industrial cartel of the Nazi state and war machine. Bering's memory survived the consolidation, and his legend in Germany approached the level of Pasteur's in France. In 1940, the Nazi Party held a grand ceremony in his honor at Marburg University. In the book published to commemorate the event, the Nazi health minister, Leonardo Conti, describes Bering as an immortal representative of German diligence, German science, and German culture. Adolf Hitler himself contributed a statement to the volume, lauding the first great international villain of monopoly medicine as a credit to the Reich. Living up to its reputation as the bad boy of ethical drug makers, Parke Davis followed the Germans' example in pushing against the boundaries of the patent taboo in the early 1900s. The most controversial episode involved the company's patents on a purified form of the hormone adrenaline that drastically reduced bleeding during minor surgeries. Made from the glands of animals, adrenaline, as Parke Davis branded it, was first made in the New York City laboratory of a Japanese expatriate chemist named Jokichi Takemini. The U.S. Patent Office's Division of Chemistry rejected Takemini's first three patent applications on the grounds that they covered a product of nature, merely isolated by the applicant. It was only with help from a team of patent lawyers that Takemini was finally granted a number of product and process patents in 1903. He promptly sold them to Parke Davis, which the following year sold $200,000 worth of adrenaline, behind the claim, as cocaine is to painless surgery, so adrenaline is to bloodless surgery. The company's attempt to corner the market on a medically important discovery did not sit well with its competitors, a number of whom entered the market in violation of the Parke Davis patents. Led by Eli Lilly and the H.K. Mulford Company, the competition cut the market for patented adrenaline by roughly half in 1905. Before Parke Davis had posted that year's disappointing sales numbers, it filed an infringement suit against H.K. Mulford in the U.S. Circuit Court for the Southern District of New York. Mulford welcomed the opportunity to take on the company and stop the Germanification of the U.S. pharmaceutical industry. In court, Parke Davis was represented by a team that included a number of lawyers last seen defending Bayer during the Aspirin Wars. Mulford, representing the ethical old guard, hired the leading patent firm in Philadelphia, Howson & Howson, and entered the courtroom continuing to trumpet its high-minded stance against drug product patents, writes the legal historian Christopher Beauchamp. For 5 years, lawyers for the two companies submitted thousands of pages of competing legal and scientific evidence. In 1911, the case landed before a 39-year-old judge named Billings Learned Hand. The Second District was the primary venue for patent cases, and Hand had adjudicated more than a dozen during his first 2 years on the bench. but none had prepared hand for the bewildering scientific, technical, and legal complexities surrounding the inventing, processing, and patenting of adrenaline. In the end, Hand upheld Park Davis's argument that adrenaline was a novel composition of matter, patentable, and not a product of nature, unpatentable. In delivering a judgment, Hand admitted his struggles to master the technical and scientific issues involved and called for the creation of a specialized patent court supported by neutral technical advisors with expertise. This idea would be taken up and championed by drug companies in the 1950s as a way to circumvent liberal federal judges, especially those of a New Deal caste who populated the Southern District. The goal was finally achieved with the establishment of the patent-focused Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in December 1981. It was around the time of Hand's decision that Francis Stewart was winding down a long career spent at the contentious outer boundary of the ethical paradigm. Although Stewart had been the first to openly question the patent taboo in the 1880s, he had since changed his mind and returned to his youthful rejection of medical patents. After closely observing how the possession and pursuit of monopoly influenced the research and business of pharmaceuticals, as practiced by the German firms and his own company, Park Davis, his swan song was a warning that patents did more harm than they could ever do good. In a report written during his final 1909 chairmanship of the American Pharmaceutical Association's Committee on Patents and Trademarks, he argued that patents blocked competition, suppressed innovation, and incentivized companies to delay publication and otherwise obstruct the free flow of information that is central to the scientific enterprise. Monopolies, Stewart concluded, make the existence of professional pharmacy impossible. However, it was too late. Stewart's earlier efforts on behalf of ethical patenting had set in motion an inertial shift already visible within the House of Medicine. In 1909, the gatekeepers at the American Medical Association politely rejected Stewart's call for a ban on medical process and product patents, calling such a sweeping policy impractical. Over the next 5 years, the AMA amended its bylaws to permit a greater array of medical patents. It justified the decision with a resolution allowing the Board of Trustees to hold patents on the inventor's behalf, provided neither the American Medical Association nor the patentee shall receive remuneration from these patents. To accept a dollar from such a patent, the Board declared, was unprofessional. The AMA would spend the remaining pre-war years debating various proposals for the creation of a central agency responsible for the ethical management of the nation's medical intellectual property. None ever came to fruition, and the project was abandoned in 1916. As war with the Central Powers drew near, a final controversy drew attention to the German firm's sophisticated use of industrial patent strategies to protect drug monopolies. The episode involved the anti-syphilitic drug Salvarsan, also known as the Magic Bullet, patented by Hoechst in 1910. The drug was in wide use in 1914 when the British naval blockade started to affect German shipping traffic. As the naval news tightened, U-boats began arriving in New York Harbor with sporadic and dwindling shipments of German goods, including patented drugs. The supply shock led to a sobering realization. American researchers had no idea how to manufacture Salvarsan. Beginning in 1915, researchers at Philadelphia's Dermatological Research Laboratories initiated a crash program to synthesize the drug based on information in the original Hoechst patent application. They found the task far more difficult than expected. Not only was the information intentionally vague and partial, it was embedded in a larger patent thicket, masterfully constructed by Hoechst's lawyers. In 1916, after the researchers succeeded in synthesizing a generic version of the drug, the director of the Philadelphia lab, Dr. J. Frank Schomburg, approached Hoechst's New York representative about acquiring manufacturing rights. When Hoechst denied the request, Schomburg proceeded to manufacture off-label Salvarsan anyway. By then, anti-German sentiment approached wartime levels of hysteria, and it took a special kind of confidence to defend the Salvarsan patent in this atmosphere. But H.A. Metz & Company, the New York firm retained by Bayer and Hoechst, had pugilistic instincts and confidence to spare. Its founding director, Hermann August Metz, was famed for a zealous commitment to protecting drug patents, even on the cusp of war and at the expense of Americans suffering with syphilis. Metz's contract to defend Hoechst's patents was short-lived. The matter was settled, together with every other German patent dispute, by America's entry into the European War on April 6, 1917. Within days, Woodrow Wilson established the Office of Alien Property and ordered its director, A. Mitchell Palmer, to confiscate all German corporate investments, including intellectual property. Palmer's haul included thousands of patents and trademarks held by German chemical and pharmaceutical interests. The U.S. government wasted no time in licensing them far and wide to American firms of every size. Many licenses were attached to federal contracts that put 200 previously imported drugs into domestic mass production. But Washington's generosity with formerly German patents was not the model adopted by a rapidly expanding industry. Following the armistice of 1918, it would become apparent that America's ethical drug companies had absorbed more from their German counterparts than the branded product lines expropriated during the war.